Welcome to session number 153, entitled, Is a Ramyumptum Just a Ramyumptum? A Freudian Approach to the Sugar Beet. The recording for this session started late, so we join presenter Matthew Schmalz, already in progress with his remarks.
I mean, big time cold feet. I thought, what am I doing? You know, going out to Salt Lake to talk about this kind of stuff. And I remembered back to my childhood, which is obviously something that Freud would find very significant. And when people would make fun of me and laugh, they'd say, Matthew, we're not laughing at you. We're laughing with you. But I wasn't laughing. That was the problem. Humor, of course, is funny. It's enjoyable. It's pleasurable. But as Freud tells us, it also has a darker side. And one of my concerns in presenting this talk is that it will seem like I, a non-Mormon, am taking the opportunity to laugh at Mormons. In response, so what I'd like to say is that in laughing along with the jokes from the Sugar Beet, I'm trying to laugh with Mormons, because when I get the joke, and I don't always get the joke, but when I do get the joke, it seems like the distance between Mormons and Catholics is very briefly compressed or compacted. And needless to say, there are many parallel jokes in my own Catholic tradition that have a similar kind of resonance. And so before we begin to look at particular jokes, I'd like to give you a brief introduction to a Freudian perspective on the human psyche, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Freud argued that one of the fundamental human psychological dynamics is repression. In order to live in society, human beings cannot give into what could be called their basic instincts for food and sex and the like. Human life, then, is a constant battle to keep these instincts at bay. Religion and morality, then, play a crucial role in this process by providing the means not only for repression, but providing context for safely discharging or channeling these repressed instincts. The subconscious, then, or the unconscious, is like a storage bin or an attic or a cellar for all these repressed desires, not to mention traumatic memories. And so the psychical energy or psychic energy humans expend in repression always is tremendous, and sometimes it's not sufficient to the task. And moreover, the subconscious, as I think we all know, is cunning and always tries to circumvent the repressive barriers that contain it. So humor then works by circumventing or moving around repressive strictures. And it evokes pleasure by accessing modes of pleasure that would normally remain inaccessible. So the pleasure of a joke then, at least in a Freudian sense, is proportional to the repression. The more psychical energy released from repression, the louder the laugh and the greater the pleasure. Freud tells us that jokes work in what could be called a triangular context then. There's the joke teller, then there's the object or the butt of the joke, and then there's the audience. And so the joke teller is seducing the audience to his or her side by an implicit offer of pleasure. And so the teller and the audience become allies against the person or institution being poked fun of. So the best jokes, from a Freudian perspective, are what are called tendentious jokes. Jokes that are not innocent, but have a purpose. And needless to say, the jokes in the Sugar Beet are, I would say, exclusively tendentious in character. The most obvious expression of this complex dynamic comes in jokes that concern what Freud would call smut. Now what Freud means by this, and okay, listen to the explanation, is he's referring to that which borders on the obscene and thus allows repressed sexual urges to be expressed. He's not making a particular moral evaluation from his own perspective, although he is drawing upon what would be social evaluations of what is inappropriate speech. And of course, smut and Mormonism hardly go together. Indeed, the phrase Mormon smut would seem to be an oxymoron given the very strong prohibitions in LDS culture against swearing or speech that refers to sexuality outside its context within marriage. And of course, Freud would argue then that this is a repressive environment. I'm not saying that I would consider that, but Freud certainly would consider it in that way. And he would also argue that the Mormon emphasis upon early marriage is an understandable, indeed necessary, response to fostering such a culture. But for this very reason, there would be a kind of Mormon smut that would allow, in a covert way, the expression and discharge of repressed sexual or, in Freudian terms, libidinous energies. So here's an example of what could perhaps be called Mormon smut from the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer. What positions are we trying from the Mormon Kama Sutra? And while you... reflect upon that, just I'm sure all of you know, the Kama Sutra is a Hindu sex manual, and I study Hinduism, and so this immediately caught my eye when I saw it in the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer. So what positions are we trying from the Mormon Kama Sutra? Retention and reactivation. The stripling warrior. Forgive me if my pronunciation isn't right. Urim and Thummim. I have two little hands. The second coming. Hi to Kolob. The PPI. I'll go where you want me to go. Give, said the little stream. The burning bush. A banner is unfurled. The secret combination. Head, shoulders, knees, and toes. Come, thou font of every blessing. Hold to the rod. Rammy Umpton. Okay, something really very interesting happened as these jokes went forward. Before we unpack it from a Freudian perspective, first, just a show of hands, just initially a show of hands. How many think this is both funny and appropriate? Okay, would anyone want to come up and anyone want to share why they think it's funny? The repressed energy is kicking in? Yeah.
Wait for him to come with the mic. You go.
Yeah.
Did you want to comment?
Yeah.
Was it comment? Or is it fun?
Yep. I think drives its humor primarily from the fact that it just takes phrases and situations that we're all familiar with in one context, thrust into a different
Okay. Well done. Anyone else want to comment on why it's funny?
This is very familiar because any teenager who sat through a boring meeting and thumbed through the pages of the hymnal would direct the reader's attention to the next title, and you come up with the same type of humor.
Okay. Okay, show of hands. Did anyone think this was unfunny and inappropriate? I mean, that some of this stuff was just inappropriate. Some of it was okay, but some of it really was inappropriate.
What about funny and inappropriate?
Well, that would be the third one. We'll see. Hugo?
Yeah, I thought some of them perhaps crossed the line that many Mormons wouldn't be there to go,
What line did they cross?
Well, masturbation, for example. Masturbation is not supposed to be funny in mainstream Mormon culture. I don't know, I'm not sure about it. Somebody didn't understand. I don't know what that means. I felt that some of them perhaps crossed the line that any Mormons wouldn't dare to go.
In front?
I think if you just came in and saw that on the screen, you would think, it's Mormon. About Mormon culture. Mm-hmm. If we didn't hear what you said before.
Okay. Okay.
So it takes what you said before to take it out of the realm, put it into a different realm.
I just said on. It's the raciest thing I've ever heard in a Mormon context.
Okay. Okay. Touche. Well, I mean, just make one more comment.
Just one quick comment. It makes me a little. I kind of wish I hadn't seen some of it because now when I see those songs, it kind of ruins it. In a religious sense.
Well, I thought it was really interesting. When I first read this, it became funnier as it went along to me because I got in the rhythm and. in some ways I got to understand it more. For you all, it was the exact opposite. It was funny initially, and then later on, at least, the laughter seemed to subside. And I think Freud would say that there's a very interesting dynamic there at work. And so from a Freudian perspective, this would be called what would be called an exposure joke. Yeah?
You're probably pushing it too far, but I think you left some gummy things off. Okay.
Okay, we'll save, like, maybe sort of that kind of commentary maybe for private consultation at the end of the talk. Okay, so this is an exposure joke from a Mormon, from a Freudian perspective. It exposes in a protective form repressed sexual impulses. So if Freud were looking at the Mormon tradition, he would see very few opportunities for expression of libidinous impulses. And this is what makes this joke particularly quite brilliant, because it points out how crucial images within the LDS tradition can be or are imbued with sexual meaning. Indeed, apart from any effort made at humor, Freud himself would probably find great significance in the term rod of iron or in the onomatopoeia ramiumpton. These terms, however, are more obviously linked to sexual images, and so they're probably less likely to evoke a humorous response. And I think, actually, we saw that. Since in order to enjoy the pleasure of sexual imagery, it must be covert. It can't be too obvious. And so the joke then also has a rather subversive valence in that it uses key Mormon terms, as you all mentioned, in a way that was never explicitly intended. And to this extent, it almost has a blasphemous quality that coexists with the humor. In fact, the humor protects the blasphemous aspect because you can simply say, I was just joking. Would you mind handing these to the audience? One of Freud's central observations is that humor provides a context in which what is normally cannot be spoken is spoken. And this applies to sexuality, and it also applies to hostile emotions. And, of course, in addition to being chaste, Mormons are known for being congenitally and habitually nice. For this reason, expressing feelings of anger for fellow Mormons might be somewhat difficult. And so what follows would be a classic hostile joke in the Freudian sense. Set it up. Condoleezza Rice and Sherry Dew. Area man believes Sherry Dew is Condoleezza Rice. Local resident Carl Sagers has put forward a theory that some experts are finding unexpectedly plausible. The well-known woman, Mormon woman's leader and Deseret Book executive Sherry Dew is leading a double life as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Quote, Dew can only rise so far inside Mormonism, says Sagers. To fulfill her ambition, she puts on blackface and jumps into the national arena as Condoleezza. Sagers has produced a chart showing that neither woman's public appearances have ever overlapped with each other. When Dew disappears on some kind of mysterious business trip, that's when Rice starts showing up in the media visiting all these hotspots around the world, Sager asserts. In addition, he believes the name Condoleezza, quote-unquote, reveals clues to the Dew connection. Dew owns a condo, has a niece named Eliza. It's not too much of a stretch to combine these two names. The double Z could reflect the boredom she feels in her Mormon role. When asked about the allegation, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said, ha, that's a hoot, as if a Mormon black woman could ever gain such a high office. This joke obviously has multiple targets. The first, most obviously, is Sister Dew, who is controversial for a variety of reasons. I learned after researching the background of this within the LDS Church and also beyond. And here she's clearly being ridiculed for her ambition, an ambition that will stop at no lengths to satisfy, at least that's what's being implied here. She's linked to Condoleezza Rice, another prominent woman who has perhaps sacrificed principle for ambition. It's also important to mention that both Rice and Dew are both single. Is Sherry Dew still single?
Yes.
Okay. That's an important element in this joke, I think, which is often taken to be signs either of their ambition or their sexuality. On one level, of course, the joke also criticizes the LDS Church that limits women to supposedly boring roles. The LDS Church and the Republican administration are thus seen as equivalents. But the denouement of the joke is perhaps the best part, because being black, a woman, and a Mormon are presented as being the equivalent of three strikes and you're out. The absurdity, then, is not Sherry Dew going out in blackface, or that she might even be Condoleezza Rice. The absurdity is that someone who is black female and Mormon could ever become Secretary of State. As Freud writes about hostile jokes, quote, the prevention of invective or insulting rejoinders by external circumstances is such a common case that tendentious jokes are especially favored in order to make aggressiveness or criticism possible against persons in exalted positions who claim to exercise authority. Closely connected with hostile jokes are cynical jokes. Hostile jokes primarily have their objects as people, and cynical jokes take aim at institutions. And what follows is a quite complex example of a cynical joke. Great. HMO bans pre-existing conditions. In an effort to break ever-increasing health insurance expenses, especially for psychotropic drugs such as Prozac, Utah-based Altius Healthcare Corporation is no longer honoring claims for conditions arising from a person's spiritual pre-existence prior to coming to this earth. Quote, we have a new rubric that helps us to determine when a mental or physical condition stems from a person's personality or covenants as determined during pre-mortality, said Altius CEO Jeffrey Bangerter, who recently completed a three-year term serving as LDS mission president in Angola. We're here to help people with health problems that arise spontaneously in this fallen world. When someone faces some inherent spiritual flaw, such as depression or obsessive compulsive disorder, or contracts a disease that is a predetermined part of their mortal program, they either need to get healed by their bishop or endure to the end. It doesn't do any good to incur needless medical expenses. Bangerd cites the example of Charles Yates of Riverton, Utah, who came down with leukemia 3 years ago. He spent the first year relying on the arm of the flesh by patronizing doctors and hospitals, and he almost lost his life before his appointed time, said Bangerder. But in doing some soul-searching, Charles realized that this disease was something he previously agreed to endure as part of his earthly challenge. When he exercised his faith enough to rely solely upon blessings from the bishop, the disease went into remission for a full 2 years before taking him. What an inspiration to us all. Cynical jokes verge on blasphemy. They are ways of undermining the authority of institutions by attacking their ideology. This joke is particularly clever because it foregrounds an easy target, a greedy HMO. In this way, it enlists us, the audience, as allies. The real target, of course, is the LDS Church and aspects of this theology that can be employed or more appropriately deployed in a way that does not take seriously the reality of human suffering. Targeted not only is a central theme of Mormon theodicy, namely that our time on earth is a kind of veil of soul-making, preparing us for exaltation, but also church authorities. Here the bishop essentially has the role of not alleviating suffering, but prolonging it. Overall, the joke also critiques the Mormon economy of salvation as an essentially exploitative capitalist economy that preaches survival of the fittest. From Freud's perspective, jokes also are commentaries on the human condition. To varying degrees, we all must subject ourselves to reason, and in doing so give up a variety of pleasures. There is thus an urge to return to a kind of childlike state of freedom. In service of this are what Freud would call skeptical jokes, jokes that bring into question all human attempts to know. Guest columnist, Brother Mac's Young Men's Class. Dear Brother Mac, we are writing you this letter because we realize that you probably thought your time as our young men instructor was a complete waste. You came to church every Sunday with a lesson prepared for us, but despite your efforts, we never seemed to listen. Most likely you went home disheartened because you could not reach us. No doubt you yearned to share your knowledge and testimony with us, but our bad behavior thwarted you every time. Well, to tell you the truth, Brother Mac, we really were listening. It may have looked to you that we were pretending to sleep or making loud snoring noises and calling out Laura Croft's name in our sleep, but we really were listening. And we thank you for all that you taught us. We're sure you remember the class when we pretended to be playing Death Pit Extreme 5, Fountains of Blood, on imaginary PlayStations, completely ignoring you and making fighting noises so loudly that we disturbed the other classes around us, forcing the bishop to chastise you for your inability to control us. But you can rest easy, because we really were listening. And now, 3 years later, we still remember your lesson that day. Poor Brother Mac, poor guy. In one sense, this joke creates a bond with the audience. Repressed guilt and repressed hostility come together here, and the laughter shared releases psychical energy associated with both. To this extent, the joke is a hostile joke and also a cynical joke. There are even smutty aspects to the joke because it goes on much longer, but I haven't included that here. The joke is calling to attention, but perhaps the main thrust of the joke concerns what Freud would call wish fulfillment. The joke is calling attention to what we would all like to be true. Whether you're a Sunday school teacher or a college professor like me, we all have ample evidence that no one listens to a word that we say. Okay, I experience this all the time. And because of this, we are especially vulnerable to people who tell us what we want to hear about ourselves. By writing an absurd letter to Brother Mac, the joke here is revealing our own very human wish to be affirmed. The joke then calls attention to that tension between reality and fantasy, between what we see and what we wish to see. And so to conclude, we can ask the question, what does Freud help us to understand about Mormon humor? In one sense, Mormon humor helps Mormons to continue to be Mormon by discharging the energy associated with repressed feelings. In Mormonism, the repression, at least from a Freudian perspective, is associated not only with sexuality, but also with continuing participation in a hierarchical institution that limits certain forms of personal expression and gender roles. Humor then creates a relatively safe place within these structures for the expression of impulses and opinions otherwise circumscribed or forbidden. But it should not be concluded from this that the humor of the sugar beet is destructive. Instead, what Freud helps us to see is that it is profoundly constructive. Freud speaks, for example, about Jewish humor and how Jewish humor reaffirms bonds within the Jewish community. The same can be said about the humor of the sugar beet. In order for the humor to be effective, it requires shared knowledge. Indeed, what I find particularly pleasurable, as I mentioned before, about the sugar beet's humor is that when I get it, I feel closer to the Mormon community than I otherwise would feel as a non-Mormon Catholic Gentile. And so Mormon humor does criticize and critique, at least the sugar beets does, but it also reaffirms the bonds of being Mormon and the power of a distinctive and shared culture.
Well, sir, I have only one disappointment with your talk before I introduce Chris. You mentioned, as a Catholic, you ought to know this, the one circumcision hymn in the Catholic hymnal, called O Sacred Head Sore Wounded. Anyway, we now are going to have our respondent, Christopher Bigelow, who is a professional troublemaker and creator of The Sugar Beet. As a diabetic, I'm not allowed to read it, but I'm sure he has some good thoughts for us. Thank you, Chris.
First of all, I want to make it clear that I'm here representing a group of about 8 people who put together this stuff, like the piece on the Kama Sutra. You could go through and identify several different people who contributed key components of that. And I think I see one of our writers here, Holly Welker, and I hope she has something to say during the Q&A on her perspective of why she enjoyed doing the sugar beet for a period of time. But you know, what you saw on the website first and then in the book later was really kind of just the aftermath of a really incredible email collaboration where the 8 or 10 of us, boy, you should read some of those emails. They were just big therapy sessions, and we went, if you thought some of that went far, that was pulling right back. I mean, we really just let the Mormon id just run rampant, and it was a lot of fun, and a few times we felt guilty. But the repression, I can very much relate to how this exercise for us was really just released the repression that each writer on the sugar beet had his or her own reasons for feeling that repression. For me, I had just come off of 6 years working at the LDS Church's Ensign magazine, where I built up a little repression. Having to write the news stories there, and then when it clicked, doing this fun kind, boy, it was therapeutic for me, and it took 2 or 3 years to lance that boil and get it all sorted out. But you know, Matthew brought up an interesting point about, if people are going to accept humor, I mean, what do you think the first 2 questions we often got when we were interviewed or when people asked us about the sugar beet were, and that is, are you Mormon? Was the first one. That was a very important question for people to ask before they decided how to take our humor. And then what do you think the next one is? Yeah, do you have a temple recommend? Are you active? What kind of a Mormon are you? And there were people I could tell were literally withholding their laughter until they had those questions answered. And others who, you know, just made choices based on the answers to those questions. And that's an interesting... A piece of humor just doesn't stand by itself. You have to look at the triangle. You have to look at the creator of the humor as well. And that was really interesting to see that dynamic play out. The other thing I do want to say is I was really, not sure what the word is, but gratified in some way to think that our Mormon humor made it all the way to Massachusetts to a Catholic university. And we've had other experiences where the Mormon humor that we really kind of thought it was for insiders mostly did build some bridges to people outside the culture. The woman who published our best of the Sugar Beet collection was a local Salt Lake woman who grew up here but was not a member of the faith. And as you can imagine, she had a little tension that she enjoyed releasing through working with us on the book. She actually was looking for an opportunity to connect more with Mormons, and this humor that we produced struck a nerve in her and made her, I think, heal some wounds of mistreatment or misunderstandings that she experienced growing up here as a child. And I think that was a really valuable, constructive thing and quite gratifying. And the other example on that I'll close with is... during the time of the sugar beet, I also was trying to sell a Mormon memoir, a Mormon missionary memoir to national presses. And I had an agent who was from the East Coast and didn't know much about Mormons. But when she realized that we had the sugar beet, she described the process to me. She would send the proposal out to a publisher in New York or wherever. And then she would call to follow up and she would say, "Now, you've got to go to this website that this guy's involved in. It's called thesugarbeet.com." And she said that you could hear the keyboard clicking on the other end of the line and a couple of moments and then, you know, a laughter. And, "Oh, this is great stuff. Send us in the whole manuscript." I mean, it was a real door opener. Didn't sell that particular manuscript, but it got me another contract to do the Mormonism for Dummies book, which includes humor. One of the main reasons they were willing to take me on with... my co-author, Jana Reese, who had all kinds of qualifications, was the sugar beet. So I just put those out as part of the experience I had, and interested to hear what some of your responses or questions might be. Thank you.
Hey. Hugo, would you put that on the stand there? All right, we are ready. Thank you, Chris, very much. We are ready now for questions and answers. It is unusual that we have this much time. Nonetheless, I would like you to ask just one question, ask it quickly, and so that we can get everybody who wants in, and then when we've gone over everybody who wants to ask and you have another question, come on back up again. So let's see who wants to begin with the questions. Right here. Come on up to the mic, please. Thank you.
I actually have a comment and, a story. I'm a Sunstoner, and my bishop finally found a comment for me that I couldn't get into too much trouble, which was the ward newsletter editor. And so I decided to magnify my calling, and I started including sugar beet articles. And my wife would kind of say, "Now listen, you need to make sure they understand it's a joke." So I would usually put on the lighter side above it so they would understand. But as time went on, I got more bold and I took that off. And I put one article about caller ID being banned in a certain state, because if you saw that it was the Relief Society president calling, you would not answer the phone. Or the former president. And so I put that in without any indication it was a joke. Well, I got a call about 2 weeks later from a member of the bishopric saying, "Brother Barris, we need to warn you that we are going to be reading a letter over the pulpit from the church. And apparently, somebody in the war didn't know it was a joke, called the church office building, and it escalated up all the way to Thomas S. Monson, who then delegated it down to somebody else. And they investigated and checked all the names and wards out, found out it was not true. But they said, you need to read a disclaimer in Sacramento and retract that article. So I'd like to thank you for that opportunity.
Are you going to sue the man for using your stuff without permission? No, okay, good. All right, who has our next comment or question? Hmm? Of course. The hardest worker here, of course.
It seems to me that I noticed one article that I have seen was so risque that later it disappeared. Is it, have you, during the period where you were putting new stuff in the original website, were there occasions of self-censorship? Did you care to elaborate on that?
Should I use this mic?
Yes, use this mic.
Yes, we definitely... we did censor some things, believe it or not. We had a few pieces, and I'm not going to tell you what they were, but they did involve the temple, and we got rid of those pretty quick without even putting them up, and felt very virtuous for doing that. And there were other pieces where we got some complaints. One of our designers, he was doing a piece, he was illustrating a piece, I can't remember what it was, but it was some kind of a disaster piece, and apparently he pulled some photo of a 9/11 people running from the building, and he used it in his photoshopped collage. And when someone pointed that out to us, I think that we took that off because it was just not very comfortable. I hope we took it off. I can't remember if we did. But. So yeah, there were definitely many other times. We played practical jokes on each other. Someone wrote a really uncomfortable. Well, I wrote a really uncomfortable piece about an area man who goes to a fertility clinic and has to... I'm not going to go. I don't know if I better go into it. And then as a joke, the designer actually put my picture illustrating. And it was a true... It was kind of a true story. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, who's next? Let's see. We have a nice gentleman here.
First of all, I'd like to know how we get the rest of this letter. And secondly, I'd like to know how I...
Bum, bum, bum.
Oh, I just apparently my memory is bad because I've read the whole thing. I'd like to know how a Catholic from Massachusetts gets involved in Mormonism and specifically Sunstone. There must be a story there.
Well, there's... a really long story, but maybe the best way to put it is just to share, just for a moment, an experience that I had recently. I've always been interested in... I'm a Roman Catholic, and there are a lot of aspects of the Roman Catholic tradition that I particularly treasure that seem quite strange to outsiders. And I've always been also the Catholic who has worked in non-Catholic contexts. I lived in India for 4 years, and most of my writing has been about Catholicism in India. And so I've been particularly sensitive to the position of religious traditions as minorities that have a distinctive culture of their own that's often not accepted by the larger surrounding culture. And so part of my interest in the dynamics of Mormonism and its theology has to do in some ways with how it casts a sort of oblique light on my own Catholic tradition, the kind of dynamics within that, but also how it provides me access into a way of looking at the world that in some ways is very similar to my own and very different. I recently wrote an article for a Catholic magazine that has a very wide circulation, a magazine called Commonweal. And it was a cover story on the LDS tradition, and particularly it focused on Sunstone, because Sunstone, it seems to me, is a real vehicle in which the diversity of Mormonism is expressed. And so that's one, and it provided me, I think, the easiest avenue to become involved in some ways, not just with Mormonism as an academic construct, but as something that involves real people. In any case, I wrote this article for Commonweal, it went through literally a year's worth of revisions, because each time they would send back the article to me saying, "Well, we think you're not you're too positive about Mormonism. You're not suspicious enough of their claims, and so on." And my whole argument in the article was to say that Mormons oftentimes experience the same kind of misunderstandings, the same kinds of distortions, and the same kind of denial of distinctiveness that Catholics have experienced, at least at different parts of the United States history. And so I sort of I said this in a presentation I gave about this, the American Academy of Religion. I sort of felt that I was kind of girding on the sword of Laban or something like that to kind of do battle with these Catholic intellectuals who weren't creating a space for Mormonism. And so I really feel very strongly that my own tradition has to make space for religious diversity, and Mormonism, and at least understanding Mormonism, is one area where Catholics have not done a very good job. And so that's to make perhaps a long story, maybe too long for this context, but thank you for asking the question.
Give me one second here. I neglected to mention that in your introduction you'd written that article. I hope they're ready to get an avalanche of requests for reprints. Are you familiar with Carl Keating, the head of Catholic Answers in El Cajon, California?
I do know about
him. He's one of my good friends. I live near him, and he's really quite remarkable. Okay, come on up.
I just wanted Matthew to know that I really congratulate you. Because Commonweal actually invited me to do that article a few years ago. And I did it, and I sent it in, and they told me that we just can't get the article we want. Everybody just says like you. They just like the, you know, they like the Mormons too much. So thank you for trying.
Well, don't sit down quite yet. Don't sit down quite yet, ma'am, please. Don't leave us hanging. Tell us your name and your qualifications.
My name's Mary Lee Mitchum, and I was a Catholic for 20 years, and I did write for Commonweal.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Who's next? A handsome young man coming up to ask a question.
My question and comment has to do with how to distinguish between really good, healthy humor and what might be somewhat harmful humor. The question that people are asking you, are you LDS? Are you active LDS? May relate to this. It's been my impression that good humor, healthy humor, is that we direct towards ourselves. It's kind of a sign of authenticity and openness, and we're able to see our silly things we do to be important, not just LDS, I'm talking in general. Whereas hostile humor starts dividing us and making us suspicious and may have some harmful elements. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Take this off and take it over there, can't we?
I suppose we could. That's why he gets paid the big bucks.
You have something to say? So
I actually do. Yeah.
Come around backwards. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
In one of the initial drafts of this presentation, one joke that I was going to draw upon, I decided not to, was one from the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer that talked about some man stalking President Hinckley as a kind of sort of, I guess, way of satirizing this sort of Mormon, you know, admonition to stay close to the prophet and so forth. And I decided that that would be inappropriate. I mean, it would certainly be inappropriate for me to mention that. Even though I think the joke when it was written, which was, you know, obviously before President Hinckley's death, was not maybe a hostile joke in the classic sense. And so I think that there, I always, I guess, use the analogy of family, that in one sense, you know, if I make fun of my own family members, then that's okay. But if someone else is going to do that, I might perceive it to be differently. And even though some of the jokes that I cited maybe did hit close to home. They probably did not hit as close to home as making a joke about the prophet. And so that is where I drew the line.
Well, certainly humor is a dangerous thing. I found that out at some of the other people on our staff. I can think of some other examples where we got some hate mail. I'll just tell you about the one where we probably got the most disturbed response was, if you read the Insight magazine and they have an article on a touchy subject that they feel they don't want the author to reveal their identity, do you remember what they always put?
Name withheld.
So we did a piece and took Name Withheld as an actual individual to whom all of these things had happened. But the article was, Name Withheld finally takes on life. And that was considered quite insensitive. Funny as hell, but just insensitive. And I think that probably cost us some fans and did a little dividing, like the gentleman said earlier. But you know, it comes with the territory. You're floating test balloons. You make mistakes. I'm sure I need to do some repenting, and some of the other writers may need to do some as well to other individuals, or I don't know. Yeah, it comes with the territory.
As someone who worked on the Sugar Beet and who wrote a fairly divisive, hostile piece, I want to discuss it for a moment. I wrote something called Church Condemns Homophobia on National Coming Out Day. And it talked about people saying things like, you know, why do we need to do anything about those disgusting homosexuals in San Francisco when God's going to kill them all one day? It's so hard living someplace like Madison, Wisconsin, where you can actually meet and get to know and like gay people before you realize how absolutely vile and reprehensible they are. And I included in a discussion of what I think is the root of all evil, the proclamation on the family. And I wrote this in response to finding out that the two men who tied Matthew Shepherd to that fence in Wyoming and left him there to die had been raised Mormon. I was so profoundly, viscerally ashamed that I felt that my church, and I will confess I am no longer an active Mormon and was not when I wrote that, but I felt that we deserved to be not merely laughed at but ridiculed, and that was my intention. I will not apologize for it. I was chastised by some of my fellow staffers. Chris ran it anyway. And I don't think it was funny. I will say that. It was satire, but I wasn't trying to be funny. I was trying to show that this thing was ridiculous, that the attitude was laughable, that if you didn't laugh at it, you would cry, which is what I did when I wrote the piece.
Thank you. One category that Freud, I guess, didn't mention, maybe it could be a category, I don't know who I'm talking to, but is innocent, unintended humor. My wife was in charge of our newsletter, and, you know, spell check doesn't always work. She wrote such things unintentionally. Didn't discover them until she read them, except for me. Please come and sing with our choir. Please feel our missionaries. A couple of other innocent, we had an English lady in our ward that stood up and said, I'd like to thank this dear bishop for the great intercourse that I've had with him. For English, that means something different than it does. Oh, the last one. I was thinking, by the way, back to my seat, I'll think of that last
one. We have someone here.
I thought I'd go to the mic. I guess so. One lady, this is my brother-in-law's ward. He tells stories, so I'm not sure that it was true, but he says in his ward, a lady stood up and cried, as so many people could testimony mean, but she apologized for being such a big boob, and the bishop, you make some of your Kestiani, or he stood up and said, innocently, nobody laughed after he said they didn't dare, you don't have to worry, sister, we love big boobs.
Someone in here that stood up? Wasn't there a lady right here that stood up and asked a question?
Yes.
As an expert on humor, what was your take on the recent New York cover with a woman on the burning flag, the New Yorker cover that claimed to be satire?
I loved it. I thought it was great. I mean, it was just that kind of risky, dangerous poking a needle in the balloon of people who have all these, I'll say, irrational fears about Obama. I just loved it. I didn't think... But I've read some other funny stuff about the lack of humor that we're able to share about Obama. The late-night hosts have all really held back, haven't they, on humor on Obama? And I guess it... Is it because of the racial sensitivity mostly?
Yes.
May also have... I mean, it's interesting to watch. There's a lot of restraint going on, I think.
Okay, do we have anybody? We have time for one or two more questions. Anybody, or else we'll just go ahead and thank, I guess. Do we have one more? Okay, good. One more, and then we'll close the session. Please come up to the microphone.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask, where you can buy your books, and what is a
That's always a good question to close on, isn't it? Benchmark Books does have just a couple copies over here in the Sunstone Book Room, and I think Sam Weller's and Borders have had it, and Barnes & Noble and Amazon. It's pretty widely available. The Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer.
Yes.
And then the last question was Ramiemptum. That's a great word. I just love that word. My blog is called Bigelow's Ramiemptum. I just love the word. But it means it's from Allah what? 30 in the Book of Mormon. 33?
31.
30-31. What is it? It's that high stand where a certain group... It was one of the more absurd moments in the Book of Mormon where they went up and... gave some pre-memorized strange prayer. Does that ring a bell at all?
In the article I wrote for Commonweal, Ramiemptum was the image. And it's about Prophet Alma visiting the Zoramites. And what they do is they have this stand called the Ramiemptum, and they go and they climb up on the Ramiemptum and proclaim their own righteousness. And Alma is aghast at this. And I use the image to kind of poke a finger in the eye of my own Catholic tradition when it gets up on the Ramiemptum to criticize other religious traditions.
Well, let me just... Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Let me just say a couple of things. We've come to a pretty pass here when a Catholic guy has to explain to a Mormon audience. Good grief. I'm not a Mormon either, so I'm glad to be able to explain it. What a great session this has been, and Chris and Matthew, thank you both very much. And of course, if Chris had any class, he'd be like Oprah and have a copy of the book for everybody here. I'm not counting on that. I want to, let's give our speakers a real big hand again. Your questions, and a special thank you to Hugo up front, who was conscripted at the last minute to help out. Thank you all very much. Have a great rest of the Sunstone Symposium.